This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Night Dahlia, written by R.S. Belcher, performed by Bronson Pinchot. To Robert B. Parker and Raymond Chandler, Jeff Rice, Chris Carter, Warren Murphy and Richard Sapir, to Elmore Leonard, Ambrose Bierce, John D. McDonald, Humphrey Bogart, and William Goldman, for bringing me upright, and to Phil Rowe, the man who introduced me to most of them, to the memory of John Weddle, for whittling and picking the guitar and belly laughter, for the smell of sawdust, for being a kind, patient, and gentle man, to the memory of Paul Franco, soldier, father, loving warden of the earth. You could make flowers grow in a desert. So much strength and so much kindness in one man is truly a gift to all who have the privilege to know him. Thank you. And to the memory of my dad, Harrison Gordon Belcher. Thank you for that one good memory. I know you tried. Rest. To my mom, Mabel T. Belcher, who took me fishing when she hated worms, camping when she hated bugs, and sat in warm silence with me as we both read. You taught me how to be brave when you are trembling, and to endure the unendurable. You are all fathers to me. To my godson, John Siegfried Peraro Santos, I'm very proud of the young man you are growing up to be. To my children, John, Emily and Stephanie, I love you all more than there are words to express. You are my light.
1. I watched the playground on the other side of the high chain-link fence, trying to figure out which of the elementary school children had the gun. The kids were doing like kids do, running around, chasing each other in circles, laughing, screaming. A few climbed on the monkey bars, others jockeyed to get a turn on the swings or the slide, a few played hopscotch. I couldn't recall ever being that young, happy or clueless. I hoped to hell I could keep them that way. Hoped to hell, I'm a fucking riot. The sun was beating down on me, but no one had noticed I didn't cast a shadow on the sidewalk. I had hocked it a while back. I was getting the stink eye from the circle of teachers near the double doors that led into the school, probably into the school cafeteria, if it was anything like my old alma mater, Welch Elementary back in West Virginia. The teacher's worried frowns as I stood at the fence, studying the children at play, insulted me. I had tried so hard to blend in. Jeans, steel-toed work boots, a maroon and black paisley button-down with the sleeves up and the tails out, an old army medic satchel hung over one shoulder as my MERS. My long black hair was pulled back in a tight ponytail. I was goddamn eye candy. Shit, I even left the Aqualung trench coat at home. It was too damn hot for it anyway. Late spring in Texas is kind of like autumn on the surface of the sun. I saw one of the teachers raise a blocky walkie-talkie to her lips and speak into it as she bored death rays into me with her baby browns. I smiled my most sincere smile. Oh, shucks, I'm just a good old boy standing here minding my own beeswax. I mean no harm to y'all's this planet. And lit up an American spirit. I needed to find the little darling quick because I was sure I was about to get a visit from the school's cop and I didn't have time to try to convince Officer Friendly I wasn't a perv or a psycho. I tuned out the heat, the teacher's resting bitch faces and the sounds of traffic behind me. I did catch a quick burst of a car's radio through a roll-down window blasting Nasty Freestyle by T. Wayne. Then I pushed that away, too. I focused on the tingling pressure up and down my spinal column, the bone road to the seat of self. I felt a geyser of aggressive, passionate, and destructive crimson power wash over my root chakra and gush upward to guide my ajna, my third eye. My gaze was pulled to the far left, near the school's brick wall, and I found the source of the scarlet energy. It was a little boy, about 9 years old, wearing a red and purple striped T-shirt, jeans, and an Avengers backpack. He was pulling something out of it, looking about furtively as he did. His eyes were wide, unblinking, and glassy. His skin was like wax. He was licking his lips. We locked eyes, the child and I knew. And so did the thing behind his eyes. "Excuse me," a deep voice with a Texas twang next to my ear said. "Is there a problem, sir?" I knew from the tone, from the way he spit out, "sir," that he was a cop. "Yeah," I said, my West Virginia accent in full bloom as I blew smoke in the cop's eyes and ducked around him, running fast. "Call for backup. That kid's got a fucking gun." I sprinted to the end of the fence, turned the corner, and passed through the open gate toward the boy. The teachers were reacting to my dash, and I had to put my shoulder into one of them to knock him out of my way. Two others grabbed at me, though, trying to stop me.
"Settle down now,"
one of them growled. He was sincere in wanting to protect the kids, but he didn't move or grab me like someone who's gotten into too many scraps.
"Hey, don't you move," the cop yelled after me.
There was a snap, like a firecracker, then another, then the screaming began.
"God damn it,"
I said, struggling with the two men grabbing my arms. The playground crowd began to part as kids ran. There were two children on the ground in widening pools of blood near the 9-year-old who was brandishing an old Colt Army 45.
"Face July Globus Dormiat,"
I shouted as I opened my Muladhara lens instinctively, gesturing at the boy's gun. It wasn't my most elegant working, but my close to a carton of cigarettes a day habit was making my lungs feel like they were being grated like cheese as I struggled with the teachers in the oppressive heat. I felt my spell wrap around the pistol in the kid's hand and then felt the crimson power radiating from the boy tear my working like cobwebs. Muladhara against Muladhara energies usually meant the bigger predator won. Not a comforting thought. I was used to being the biggest predator on the playground. The spell did get his attention, and the boy pointed the gun in my direction and fired. I twisted one of the teachers trying to pin me, wrenching him between me and the gun. The man jerked as a bloody hole exploded in his back. He slid to the ground, convulsing in shock. I watched the life leave his eyes as he slid off me. The kid's face twisted in anger. I tripped the other teacher struggling with me, and the kid shot him in the face as he fell forward. The school resource officer who had hassled me at the fence was only a few steps behind me as the second teacher fell. He raised his gun and aimed at the boy.
"Joey," the cop called out, "put that gun down right now, son. Do it, or I'll have to shoot you."
The kids were fleeing through the double doors back into the school, blocking the cop's shot. Joey decided to make a run for it with them.
"Joey,"
the cop shouted and began to move into the screaming stream of children. Joey was lost in the blur. There was a loud bang, and the cop fell onto his back. I knelt beside him and saw he was still breathing. Probably a vest. I picked up the cop's 9mm and continued after Joey. I don't like guns. They make it too damn easy to kill. Even psychotics and children can pull it off with their help. However, bullets are faster than just about any magic spell you can care to lob, and I, for one, was not going to be the brain donor bringing magic to a gunfight. Terror was smeared across the air of the cafeteria, shrieks of sanity being pulled loose at the seams, and sobs of innocence dying. Another gunshot. I dropped low behind a table by the door and found three little kids looking at me with huge eyes, moist with fear. "Stay here," I said. "Help's coming." In the grand scheme of things, it was the lamest shit I could utter, but it was all I had. That kind of bullshit still played with kids this age. They still believed in "help's coming" and "everything will be okay." I made my way back up the brick hall to the double doorway that led out into Matthew Stone Elementary School Central Corridor. A little girl, maybe 5 or 6, lay by the doorway, her tiny chest dark and wet with blood, her eyes fighting to stay open. They were pretty eyes, too.
"Why?"
she asked me weakly.
"Why did Joey hurt me? I thought he was nice."
I knelt by her and brushed her hair, slick with blood, out of her hazel eyes. "It ain't Joey, darling.
I said softly.
Am I going to die?
The little girl asked.
No, honey,
I lied. There are going to be some nice people coming along in a little bit. They're going to want you to get up and go with them. You do that, and I promise you they will fix you right up, okay? No more pain.
Okay,
the little girl said. She looked past me.
Oh,
she said.
They're so pretty.
She smiled at me. Some blood drooled out of her suddenly slack mouth, and she died. I set the gun down next to her. I didn't want to touch the damn thing anymore. I closed her eyes, crouched beside her there for a moment, waiting for some higher power to do the right fucking thing by this child and give her life back. When that wasn't forthcoming, I got back to my feet. I didn't worry about fingerprints on the gun. I had cooked up an enchantment on my prints and DNA a long while back that gave computers and technicians fits. I followed the sounds of fear and death to their source. It wasn't the first time I had heard those sounds, and it sure as hell wouldn't be the last. There were sirens outside now, lots of them. I saw news trucks as I passed the window, clustering around the cops and EMTs like fucking maggots squirming on a carcass. At least they were predictable. I walked down dark, cool corridors of hastily locked doors decorated with big construction paper suns smiling down on stick-figure children. First names of students written on little laminated clouds denoted their homerooms. My footsteps echoed along the tiled walls. I smelled gun smoke and piss. Smeared finger paint art projects, book reports written on wide-lined practice paper with colored drawings to accompany them were like chains of islands between the doors. I could hear trembling voices whispering behind those doors. The fear of the children and the adults sworn to protect them huddled in the classrooms, waiting, praying. It was palpable. Those voices, the words, the images on the wall. This place was custodian of the future, and the thing ahead of me wanted to murder it all for its own sick pleasure. There was so much primal force at work here, so much relentless, inevitable death, and so much desperate, aching life, the two surging, clashing, crashing. Someone like me, a magus, a shaman, faker, medicine man, a miracle worker, could take those energies and stoke them, build on them to make themselves even more powerful, more like a god. The universe hits back, though, and it was always a price paid for power culled from trauma. Believe me, I know all about that. I could teach a fucking class. Back home, they called me a wisdom. The trail to Joey included two more dead bodies, another child and another adult, maybe a janitor. I was walking toward death yet again, and I felt next to nothing, aside from a yearning not to be present in this awareness. The wider the doors of perception were thrown open, the more you began to wish someone would shut the fucking door and stop letting all the damn flies in. 20 feet from his last victim was an open door labeled storeroom. For a second I wished I had kept the gun. I have never been big on dying for principle, but it was too late now. I stepped into the storeroom, more like a closet on steroids, shrouding myself in my own mystical and mental defenses as I did. Little Joey was sitting on the edge of a work table, the semi-auto .45 pistol in his hand. His skin was corpse-colored, glistening with sweat, and his eyes were fractured with broken blood vessels. He raised the pistol. The slide was locked back. It was empty.
"All out of bullets,"
the boy said. His voice was wrong. Too deep. Too mature to be coming out of a 9-year-old's mouth. He began to laugh as he dropped the gun to the floor.
"Too bad. I was having a great time."
"Recess is over, asshole," I said. I aligned the energies inside my body, visualized them like jewels glittering in a vertical row, preparing them to begin. "Time to go back home, Dean."
"How the fuck do you know who I am?"
the monster inside the child rumbled. The kid was running hot. I could feel the heat coming off his skin from 10 feet away. You're also killing your host like any good parasite does, I said. Joey dies, you go back in, Dino.
Then I'll take this little fucker with me,
Dean said.
Last one for the road. Besides, it ups my kill count.
Okay, I said. We're done here. I began to flex my Manipura chakra through my solar plexus, drawing all my personal energy in and the universe's raw fuel to boot. I visualized it as a cleansing white light, growing, building, a storm of pristine purity. I felt Dean's crimson Muladhara energy, his base animal desire to survive at any cost, grow and thrash in reaction to my marshalling of powers.
I claimed this child, Dean snarled.
Some sounds like dogs ripping apart meat issued from the boy's mouth. The temperature in the storeroom dropped to that of a meat locker as he stole its energy. Joey's eyes were now blazing as if they were made of red-hot metal.
I am one of the hungry, the lonely ones, pushed from the accursed radiance by jealousy and hubris. Your petty magics are no match, little mortal, for one who has embodied hate against your kind since the human heart first beat.
I lowered my face. The boy was rippling with waves of heat like hot asphalt, clashing with the numbing Arctic cold. Dean hopped off the table's edge and took a step toward me.
I am Zipar, he said, the bringer of madness, and you are nothing to me, little cosmic speck.
I looked up into the possessed child's face. I couldn't help but grin.
Horseshit, I said, dragging the word out a bit with my drawl, and dropped my shroud of protective disciplines and gestured with a fist toward the child, launching a spear of pure cleansing light at the demon. The thing screamed, and I could hear the boy screaming, too.
Zipar, I said. Really? Shit, Dean, that sounds like one of those medicines on the commercials where they tell you to seek medical help for a hard-on that lasts longer than 4 hours. Check with your doctor to see if Zipar is right for you.
It burns,
the demon whined. The light was pinning it in place.
Yeah, I'll bet it stings a bit. You're not Zipar, the bringer of madness. Does old Z even know that you're using his moniker up here? He's going to be pissed when you get back, Dino. They have trademark infringement laws in hell. Probably got enough lawyers down there with time on their hands.
The boy had dropped to the floor, first to his knees and then onto his back, writhing. His tongue was flickering in and out of his mouth, but the man's screams and the buzzing of insects continued issuing from him, unabated.
Your name is Dean Coral, I said, and you were a serial murderer of young boys. You raped, tortured, and murdered over 28 kids before one of your scumbag accomplices shot you dead in 1973. You were a mortal speck, just like me, pal.
Please make it stop. It hurts, Coral said. It's burning me and the boy. It's tearing his soul.
You've been everyone's punk-ass bitch in the big empty for over 40 years, Dino, I said, and you decided to make a break for it when Joey here and his mother moved into your old house on Lamar Drive. Isn't that right? Now get your ass out of that mobile home and run on back to hell. Your landlord's waiting for you.
No,
Coral hissed.
This sweet little thing is mine. Mine. I'll not give him up. I've planted my roots in his tender essence, and I won't easily be pulled out. If you don't stop this, you'll shred his soul. Who are you, anyway, to order me about, to have so much power tucked away at your call, to dare to face one of the fallen with no protections, no fear?
You're more like the stumbling than the fallen, and only a poser, a wannabe, would call themselves that anyway. I'm Ballard, Latham Ballard, and if you really want the rough trade, man, you got it.
As the light held him fast, I began to intone the ritual of exorcism, one of the variations I was taught over 30 years ago from a gruff old demonologist and his sweet gray-haired hymn-singing wife. It called on the nurturing powers of creation to compel the hungry to depart the innocent host.
It could take days, months, or even longer. But with all this pure Manipura energy behind it, a lightweight like Dean here should be heading for the exit. Instead, Coral began to laugh, even as tears rolled down poor, convulsing Joey's cheeks.
You have some balls even uttering those words, half-soul man,
Coral growled.
We know of you in the empty places, Ballard. Ballard, the corrupt Nightwise. Ballard, who supped with our master and skipped out on the check. Ballard, whom both monsters and saints fear and pity. You dare try to dislodge me from my meat with pretty, pretty, holy words. You've bargained away pieces of your soul for petty powers and shallow favors. You're bound for a far greater hell than I. Ballard, you have no moral authority over me,
the child-defiling demon said.
Keep trying to pull me out, and you'll add this boy to the endless roll of all those you have damned in your miserable life.
He was right, unfortunately, about all kinds of things. He'd have to willingly come out of there, and all that would be waiting for him was hell, so I had to sweeten the pot a bit, or maybe more like piss in it. The spiritual light diminished and was gone. Coral guffawed, sounding for all the world like a rutting pig. Before he could rise off the floor, I took something from my shirt pocket and knelt beside him. It was a 3-inch-long, dull, rusted needle. I placed it on Joey's chest and uttered, Malum manere donec venium ad hoc formana modus fuero. Then I grabbed an industrial-sized jug of bright blue window cleaner off the shelf next to me. Fine, I said. Suit yourself. I unscrewed the cap of cleaner and took a whiff.
What is that?
Coral said. He tried to rise, but discovered he couldn't. If you're staying at the party, I said, you might as well have a drink. I pinched Joey's nose and began to pour the window cleaner down his throat. The boy and the demon choked and hacked as the toxic gunk went down.
What the fuck are you doing?
Coral sputtered as I tipped the bottle back up.
Are you actually trying to kill the boy?
Yep, I said, I am. That little needle there came out of the pelvis of a guy by the name of Albert Fish. He killed kids, too, more than you. He thought God was telling him to do it, go figure. Old Al was a self-mutilator besides being a homicidal fuck, and he would drive needles into his body. A buddy of mine who collects high-end weird shit got this for me. It's got some power to it, bad power, and I figured it would have a good resonance with you, Dino, and looky there, it does. You can't come out of that body until I take this off the kid's chest, and yeah, I'm gonna fucking kill him, and his soul will fly off to a real sweet place, maybe back into the big old cosmic rinse cycle, where hopefully he won't draw the get-possessed-by-a-C-list demon fucktard card again. I poured another big drink of the poison down the kid's throat. Joey and Coral both gagged and coughed. I stopped pouring again. I heard shouts and bullhorns far away. I was running out of time. You see, Dino, I continued, wherever the poor kid's soul ends up, it's better than being with you. So happy ending for little Joey. I'm not sure what kind of ending for the mighty Z-par, however. Hard to say.
You're bluffing, Coral said. You came in here, tried to stop me because you wanted to save the boy. You won't kill him now.
Actually, I said, pouring more of the poison out of the jug again into the struggling boy's mouth, I'm here for you, Dino. I don't give a fuck what happens to this kid or anyone else. You read me my bio. You think I won't? Stick around and find out, Huckleberry. This is a contract job for your landlord. You know, the one you call... I tried to do my best Igor impersonation, which is kind of rough when you have a West Virginia drawl.
The master.
Oh, shit.
Coral gasped around more of the poison splashing into Joey's mouth.
Wait, wait.
The power of Windex compels you, fucker, I said.
Jesus,
Coral screamed, squirming.
Stop, stop, please don't.
I slipped this needle into the boy's body somewhere and you're anchored for good. My best guess is that after the agonizing stomach cramps and painful as shit death from his nervous system shutting down, I said, you'll just be trapped in there until the body decays, locked in that rotting meat jail until everything that is Dean Coral just fades away into oblivion. It's a harsh ending, Dino, but it satisfies my employer, so
I'll leave. I'll fucking leave, Coral said. Hurry up. I can feel that shit starting to affect his nervous system.
I put the cap back on the jug and placed the boy's hand around the plastic handle. I put my hand on Fish's needle.
I ever catch you in this world again, I'll finish the job next time. This is my fucking house, bitch. I'll be waiting in line for you when you get to hell, Ballard,
Coral said. I lifted the needle off the boy's chest, and the thing that had been Dean Coral departed with a moan like a hot desert wind. It left the dank, cloying stench of rancid blood and candy in its wake.
Yep, I said, slipping open my satchel, but your punk ass will be way in the back of the line, Dino.
I stood, tucked the needle away in my pocket, and slipped on a dark blue windbreaker I had removed from my bag. On the back in bright yellow letters was the word press. I also removed a lanyard with an official laminated press photo ID, a baseball cap with the logo of the Houston Chronicle, a local newspaper, on it, and a very nice digital Nikon camera. I knelt down beside the kid and waited for what I knew was coming next. Joey was breathing, a little ragged but still alive. Fun fact, you can drink a small amount of window cleaner, about 2 ounces an hour, and get wasted off of it, but too much does fuck up your nervous system and can kill you. You find out all kinds of neat life hacks like that when you vacation at rock bottom. A pair of cops in tactical gear, probably the point on a SWAT team, appeared on either side of the open door.
Don't move!
One of them shouted. I put my hands up. I think he's trying to kill himself, I said. He drank a bunch of this blue cleaning shit. He was like this when I came down the hall.
Keep your hands up. Stand and move over to the side, the other cop said. Jesus, it's the shooter, all right. We need medics in here now.
One of the SWAT cops frisked me and spun me around, reading my press ID.
How the fuck did you get past the lines and get in here, asshole?
Hey, look, I'm sorry, man, I said. I'm new, and I was just trying to
get him out of here.
An older tactical cop with sergeant stripes said as he entered the room with the EMTs,
place is getting too damn crowded.
They confiscated my camera and ran my press credentials. My hacker, Grinner, had been good to his word and worth every penny. The fake ID stood up. In less than an hour, I was walking away from the school and dumping my career as a photojournalist in a trash can next to the bus stop. While they were vetting me, they brought Joey out on a stretcher. He was handcuffed to it. He was awake and crying, calling out for his mother. I felt a cowardly relief pass through me at the thought that I didn't have to be the one to tell the boy his mother had been his first victim. I'd seen her body in the hallway of their quiet home. I imagined the nightmare existence Joey was going to have now. The horrors outside and inside eating him until the day he departed this earth. Death would have been more merciful. Kid hadn't done a thing wrong, just got handed a shit deal. My job was done. I had done the best I could. I was never supposed to win this, never supposed to get there in the nick of time to make it all right for anyone except the manipulative bastard who sent me here. There was a clusterfuck from the jump. I hailed a cab.
Drive,
I said, handing the guy $100 and fumbling for a cigarette. I kept thinking that if I looked behind me, Joey would be there staring at me.
Where?
The cabbie asked.
Away, I said. Fast!
2. The Voodoo Queen on Milby Street was a dive that tried a little too hard to be a dive. It made the hipster kids feel like they were really slumming without the need for paying gangland tolls and packing pistols. I liked the joint from my last visit to Houston because the music was good and the folks there didn't skimp on the alcohol in their drinks. I bypassed the voluminous menu of concoctions that came in hollowed-out pineapples and fish bowls with little totem poles of fruit spears and paper umbrellas for buying the lone bottle of Pappy Van Winkle Reserve they had up on the top shelf.
The fetching lass that sold it to me had hair dyed white and a tapestry of tattoos covering her slender body.
"You're kidding," she said. "That's like a $3,000 bottle of 23-year-old whiskey. You know that, right?"
I handed her a wad of cash. "Here's 4K, I said. "It's a tip for being the prettiest sight I've seen all day, darling." The bartender looked at the money, back to me, and stepped to the back bar to count the bills and make sure they weren't faked by the light of the enormous fish tank full of brilliantly colored clownfish that adorned the back wall of the bar. She came back with the bourbon like she was cradling the Ark of the Covenant and a glass tumbler.
"Ice?"
she asked.
"Be like pissing in holy water."
"What's the special occasion?"
"That's my birthday," I said, getting up from the bar.
"Happy birthday,"
she said, and actually meant it.
"Hey, I get off at 8. I've never tasted 23-year-old bourbon before."
"Well, come find me," I said. "I'll introduce you to it, but I suspect that whiskey is older than you are."
She laughed, and I retreated to the shadows of the bar floor. Funny thing, when you buy a bottle like this, they pretty much let you camp any damn place you please. I went around a velvet rope and sat myself down in a corner booth of a closed section. The only lights in here were the small round fills built into the ceiling, bright light under them, and deep shadow all around. I could still hear the music from the jukebox. It was playing the Swans cover of Can't Find My Way Home. I poured a drink and sipped it like the first kiss from an old lover in a long, long time. I had stayed dry for 11 months, Magdalena's influence on me. She was gone. Little Joey was gone. Gone, baby, gone, like the song goes. But Dean fucking Coral would go on forever. That little girl was gone, but my evil ass sat right here in air-conditioned comfort, getting good and tight.
Cheers!
Seeing children's brains sprayed all over the walls seemed as good a reason as any to take a flying leap off the wagon. I drained my glass. It was smooth as Sinatra, worth every penny. I poured myself another one, saw that little girl's eyes as she slipped away, and toasted the darkness.
"Happy birthday, asshole," I said.
Half a bottle or so later, a waitress came back to see how I was doing. I told her to bring me a bottle of the cheapest, nastiest tequila they had and a Budweiser in a bottle. I gave her $500 for her trouble. After that, I had no shortage of customer service. The bottle of tequila was almost gone, and a forest of empty brown beer bottles covered the table. The afternoon crowd in the bar had mostly been office folks skipping out for a beer at lunchtime, a few college kids with no classes and money to burn, and of course my people, the barflies who didn't give a fuck about the decor or the crowd as long as there was a seat for your ass and booze to whittle away the hours of your life until the end. There is a certain Zen meditation present in hardcore alcoholism. The evening crowd was in now. It consisted of more sketchy locals from the second district, the surrounding neighborhood, and swarms of hipsters nursing the one PBR they could afford. There was a battle over who was setting the tone for the night on the jukebox, the music jumping from blues to dance to country. I did my part for the war effort by tossing in Johnny Cash's cover of I See a Darkness and followed it up with F. Flay's Blood in the Cut. Take that, alt folks scum. I paid the club manager a grand to keep my section closed. I wanted to be in a fishbowl watching life, seeing how normal assholes spent their Friday night. I had almost finished off the Pappy Van when the tattooed bartender walked up to my table with a stride like a panther. The black lights made her white hair almost glow.
"You didn't forget about me, did you?"
she said over the throbbing music and the traffic jam of voices. She had a glass in her hand. I nodded for her to sit, and she did. I poured her a glass, the last of the bottle, leaving a single swallow for myself. She raised the glass, and I raised the bottle.
"Happy birthday,"
she said,
"and congratulations on another successful fulfillment of your ongoing obligation, Latham."
I paused in drinking the last of the bottle and cocked my head at the bartender, who drained her glass and sighed. I looked across the bar and saw the same bartender, same tattoos, same hair, waving bye to the other bartender on duty as she headed for the door, her purse over her shoulder.
"That,"
said the bartender sitting across from me, is what sin tastes like. I slipped a cigarette between my lips.
Got a light? I asked the devil.
You had two images prominent in your mind, the embodiment of all malice said as she lit my cigarette like any good bartender would. This sweet young thing you visualized rutting with, and that dead little girl back at the school. Since it was your birthday, I chose, sorry for this, the lesser of two evils.
What do you want? I asked. You are assassinating a very expensive buzz. I did your dirty work, and you got your AWOL scumbag back.
You did, Latham, it said. I would have manifested sooner, but I had to wait until your consciousness was altered sufficiently for us to interact. I wanted to congratulate you on heroically saving that poor boy's life, Latham. Bravo.
Fuck you, I said, and drained the last of the bourbon. It tasted like ashes.
Technically, fuck you,
she replied, pouring herself a glass of the last of the oily tequila. Since you were the one who bartered away 3 years of your life in my service in exchange for those wishes you needed so desperately at the time.
I watched the devil drink the last of my booze.
I think there was a metaphor in there somewhere.
Haven't we had fun these past few years? Me breaking up the wearisome monotony of your plodding march toward self-induced oblivion with my little honey-do list of tasks. You, a villain most foul, given chances over and over again to act the hero like you did today. Tell me, hero, how does it feel to be back on the side of the angels?
I looked across the table for anything left to drink. There was nothing. I looked up at this thing of purest self-hate, conjured out of my own mind, and said nothing. There was nothing to say. The devil knows you because the devil is you. She went on, taking one of my American spirits out of the crumpled and almost empty pack.
I wanted to congratulate you, she said,
lighting the cigarette between those full lips,
and let you know I was here to give you a little birthday present of my own. You have worked off about a year's worth of your debt in the past two. I am forgiving almost all of the remaining time on your account tonight, my dear Latham.
Almost, I said, leaning across the table, knocking several beer bottles over as I did. I think a few smashed on the floor.
I'm holding on to 1 minute, the devil said. That's all. One measly minute, and of course the ragged chunk of your soul invested in that time will remain in escrow until that minute is paid. Am I not a generous god?
You're what my granny would call a hoodoor, I slurred. My companion nodded.
Well said. How is your dear grandmother these days? Don't hear much from her since you helped her all those years ago, eh, hero?
I roared and launched myself across the table at the son of a bitch. The table tumbled over as I fell. Bottles shattered everywhere. I was on the floor with all the other broken things trying to get back up. The pretty bartender was gone. I was alone. I had been alone the whole time.
Okay, big spender, time to call you a cab.
Thick hands lifted me off the floor and to my feet.
Let go of me,
I said articulately and tried to pull away. It didn't work. The guy holding me was a good 6 inches taller than me and outweighed me by maybe 80 pounds. He had a hardness behind his eyes that told me the smile fixed on his face was a lie. If I pushed, he would beat the hell out of me.
You have any idea who you're fucking with?
I said. Look, friend, the bouncer said, walking me out of the closed section. Let's just go outside and talk about this, okay?
Fuck you,
I said and took a swing at him.
I'm fucking Latham Ballard, you motherfucker.
It connected, but there wasn't anything behind it. I might as well have slapped him with a bar rag. I tried to put together a spell, some kind of spell, death spell, firefall. My concentration was like mercury, and my energies were as scattered as any other broken-down old drunks would have been. The bouncer snapped off two quick, tight jabs at me. He wasn't just a meathead that stood at the door and checked ID. He had training. There were bright lights popping behind my eyes, and I was falling. Then there was a movement after some time in the dark. A female voice was near my ear.
Who did he say he was?
Nobody, just an old rich drunk, I heard the bouncer telling the girl, celebrating his birthday a little too hard. He was back there talking to himself for the last half hour. There was a hole in my memory after that. My next awareness was the smell of garbage. I climbed to my knees and looked. I was in an alley next to a dumpster overflowing with kitchen trash. I had no idea where I was or how much time had passed. I slid back down and my face hit the sticky asphalt. I slept. Someone was turning me over. The man's face was square and bland in its ugliness. He had short, thinning blonde hair. He wore an expensive suit with his cheap haircut. "It's him," Square Face said to someone. He had a British accent. "Fuck off," I said. It was still dark, and all I wanted to do was go back to sleep. Blondie grabbed me by my shirt and hauled me to my feet. I drove a right into his jaw, and this time it had a little something behind it. He staggered back, shaking his head. I was in another alley filled with dumpsters. I had no clue where I was. There was a black SUV, a Mercedes-Benz, idling with its lights on. Squareface's companion stood by the car. He held his arms behind his back. He was black, taller than me, and dressed better than his partner. He wore the expensive clothes better than Squareface, too. He had his black hair cut very short, almost military fashion, and he had a neatly trimmed goatee. His eyes were hazel, and his features were fine, with slightly pointed ears, a slender nose, and good cheekbones.
"There's no need for that, Mr. Ballard," Cheekbones said. "It's been my experience that when someone says that, there's absolutely a fucking need for whatever that is. In this case, I threw a shaky uppercut at Squareface. He blocked it and planted a solid one in my gut. I dropped to my hands and knees and vomited on his testoni shoes.
"Shit, mate!"
Squareface snapped a kick at my face, which my booze-drowned brain registered as a hapkido kick in the instant prior to me blacking out.
"You sure this is the guy?"
a voice asked. There was a reply and more talking, but I slid back into anesthetized slumber bordering on poison coma. Time passed. My face ached. My jaw ached. My ribs ached. My brain spun in the darkness of my skull. I smelled my own stale vomit and piss. I was placed in a comfortable seat and belted in. Cool air blew on my face. I slept. I awoke and asked for water through swollen lips to match my swollen eyes.
"Fuck you," a familiar British voice said. "Legend my ass, this toss is a fucking bum."
"You're just mad about your shoes," another voice without the English accent said, and I laughed. Then, at some future point on the other side of dizzy, nauseous blackness, a cool glass was placed to my lips.
"Drink slowly,"
a voice that wasn't Squareface said. The tiny sliver of my brain that had avoided the deep fryer figured it for Cheekbones. I drank the cold water, swallowed, and then slept again. Time passed. I dreamed. I was talking to the little dead girl. She had lost her doll in a blood-painted maze. I wandered with her and tried to help her find it. The maze never gave up the doll or offered a way out. I awoke to being carried by my two well-dressed keepers off some kind of airplane and deposited in the back of a limo.
"Where are we going, fellas?"
I muttered. Neither of them answered me. I sunk into the leather seats and sighed.
"This thing have a bar?"
I asked Cheekbones. If he answered me, I didn't hear it before I slept again. 3. Afternoon sunlight filtered through the antique lace curtains. I was in a bed with an excellent mattress and feather pillows. The thread count on the sheets was a number approximating the national debt. There was a pitcher of ice water on the bed next to me, along with a small bell and several bottles of salt tablets, analgesics, and stomach medicine. There was also my crushed but serviceable brown package of American spirits and my tarnished old Zippo. I sat up and winced a little from the soreness in my side and stomach. Had I gotten kicked? When I blinked, it hurt. I touched my face. My lips and eyes were sore and puffy, but the swelling was already receding.
I had been in a scrap, but I'd had much, much worse. I did my requisite 10 minutes of hacking and coughing, paying my tribute to the god of nicotine with an offering of lung tissue. I slipped out of the clean, comfy sheets and discovered I was naked. I checked myself for any injuries other than the ugly green and blue bruise on my side. The old bod was still getting by, covered in tattoos and scars. My meat biography. For a fellow of my advancing decrepitude, I was holding up okay. I was still cut like Iggy Pop, old the heroine, still had all my hair. It was falling down to my shoulder blades, and the majority of it was still black. Still had most of my teeth, but not for lack of trying. I looked out the window and saw endless, perfect green, a verdant lawn worthy of the Elysian fields. I was either dead and in the wrong place, or the guest of someone who could afford to have his vast grounds manicured on a daily basis. I drank the better part of the pitcher of water, sat on the edge of the bed, and lit up a cigarette. Whoever had me didn't want me dead or at a disadvantage. They had gone to some time and trouble to patch me up. That sounded to me like a job, so I stood up and checked the closet. My clothes were all there, cleaned, pressed, and perfect. I pulled up my jeans, put on socks and boots, and slipped on the shirt. My wallet was on the shelf above the clothes. Everything was still in it, about $2,000 in cash. It should have been considerably more, but I chalked that up to my binge, not theft. There was also a bunch of credit cards and an ID, all in names that weren't mine. I gathered up my smokes and lighter, tried the door and found it unlocked, and walked out of the bedroom, buttoning my shirt as I did. The house was old. It smelled of well-oiled wood and was a little stuffy with heat. I walked down the hall past numerous doors and came to a foyer at the top of a grand staircase. I had an excellent view of a series of stained-glass mosaics that were capturing the afternoon sun. It was some of the finest glasswork I had ever seen. The colors and the designs shifted and flowed, and I suspected there might have been a bit of subtle enchantment at work in the overall effect, but if it was, it was some of the most subtle working I had ever seen. The scene depicted was a beautiful autumn forest, alive with leaves of garnet, fire, umber, and salamander. A sun and moon presided overhead, circling each other in phase dances of life, death, and rebirth. Tall, slender beings, cloaked in colors that put the leaves to drab shame, stood at the center of it all, their skin lustrous like diamonds, their eyes trackless night. Above the mosaic was a family crest I recognized. I realized who had me, and something long buried writhed in me, thrashing like a hungry eel in my guts. "Ah, Mr. Ballard, you're awake. Excellent." The voice was Irish, Gentile, and belonged to a man at my 6. He was in his late 60s, maybe early 70s. He had a full head of white hair, thinning a bit on top, and a wrinkled, ruddy complexion with prominent laugh lines. I liked him almost instinctively. I think that was the point. He wore a suit and tie with a simple apron over them. "I'm Carmichael, sir, Mr. Uncouth's butler. I trust you are feeling better than when you joined us, sir." I laughed. "Yeah, I'm good. Thanks. Sorry for the mess. I reckon you had to clean that all up, huh?" Carmichael kept smiling. "Think nothing of it, sir. It reminded me a bit of earlier days here, when the house was a bit more lively and boisterous." "Well, I don't care to have anybody clean up my messes for me," I said. Someone cleared their throat. It was Cheekbones in another tailored suit, this one charcoal gray. He looked good. GQ good.
"Your history would suggest otherwise," Cheekbones said. "You seem to leave messes wherever you go and seem to have little care for the consequences to others."
"Mr. Burris," Carmichael said, "I was about to notify you that Mr. Ballard is up and about."
"Thank you, Carmichael," Burris said. "I'll take him down to Mr. Ankou."
I nodded, waved bye to the butler, and followed Burris down the staircase. "Where am I?" I asked as I lit a cigarette. Burris kept walking.
"An estate outside London," he said. "You are a guest of the Ankou family."
"Honor above," I said in a trilling language that didn't have its origin upon this earth. Burris looked over his shoulder but kept walking. "That's the house motto, isn't it?"
I said in English, exhaling a cloud of smoke. "It's more than a motto," Burris replied in the same language. It sounded like water babbling over stone.
"Someone like you wouldn't understand."
Burris took me through the manor. I walked past a parlor with ancient Middle Eastern tapestries adorning the walls. In the room, an old blind Egyptian with ram horns growing out of his temples was reclining on a mass of cushions, taking sips off a water pipe full of very pungent marijuana as he instructed a half-dozen serious-looking young men who rested on their knees with blades and guns arrayed ritually before them. Burris paused for an instant to look into the room, and a flicker of a recognizable emotion crossed his face. Gone too quickly for me to get a bead on it. We passed another room with very expensive antique furniture. A circle of ladies practiced needlepoint and spoke quietly among themselves. Their garb ran from Victorian-era gowns to modern casual. The matriarch of the circle was an old woman, easily in her 90s, with giant moth wings of dusty gray twitching at her back as she jabbed a bony finger at a young girl who was looking down, admonished and blushing. Burris opened a glass door that led to a narrow corridor, also of glass. The corridor, like an airlock, opened into a large conservatory through a door at the other end. The glass walls and ceiling were buttressed with ornate beams of what appeared to be silver. The sunlight flashed off a few of the lower beams. There were plants everywhere, mostly orchids, and the floor was dark, rich soil. I saw a few plants, I was fairly certain, that were not native to Earth. The air was hot and moist to accommodate the flora, and sweet-smelling, almost to the point of being cloying. Burris led me along well-worn dirt paths through the foliage until we reached a clearing that contained a small rattan table and four high-backed rattan chairs. A man sat in one of the chairs, sipping a cold, sweating glass of white wine. He was an average enough-looking fellow, with slightly prominent front teeth, big ears, and a mop of curly brown hair. His clothes cost more than most cars back in the States ran you. He regarded me and Burris with a look of practiced disdain reserved for the help, I'm sure. The man standing at the opposite edge of the circle was tall. He wore a white linen suit. I didn't recognize the tailor from the cut, but it made the other guy's clothes look like he shopped at Goodwill. He had a powder blue dress shirt and no tie. He had his back to me, and for a moment, when I first looked at him, he seemed larger, too large to fit in this space, too large for my mind to fully comprehend. Imagine getting a glimpse of the ocean. The whole ocean, all at once. He seemed to squeeze the enormity of his being back into a human-sized space my monkey brain could wrap itself around. He turned to look at me with dark eyes flecked with silver and a warm smile. His hair was brown, straight, and fine, and fell to his collar. He had a widow's peak. He had the kind of real tan only the rich can afford to cultivate.
Latham Ballard, the cosmic force pretending to be the tan man, said, "Please have a seat. You stay as well, Burris."
"Yes, sir," Burris said, and sat in one of the rattan chairs. I joined him in another. The tan man sat down as well and crossed his legs. As if on cue, Carmichael appeared with a tray of drinks, refreshing the wine of the guy who had been sitting when we arrived. There was a chalice of something for the tanned man. The cup was covered in what I was pretty sure were real jewels. For Burris, it looked like ice water, and for me a double bourbon on the rocks. When I sipped it, I was surprised to discover it was more of the Van Winkle Reserve.
"How do you say it?" the tan man asked. "The hair of the dog?"
"Yes." I tipped the glass at him and nodded. "That is exactly how we say it, Mr. Ankou." The tan man smiled and nodded as he sipped from his million-dollar pimp cup.
"I am Theodore Ankou, Lord of the Isles of Albion, Baron of the Blacklight Realms, High Minister to the Court of the Uncountable Stairs, and Patriarch of the Ankou clan. I trust you understand all that?"
"I do," I said. "You left out a few. I assume for brevity's sake. I am honored to be a guest in your realm, Lord Ankou." That last part I said in the slippery-sounding liquid language of the Fae that Burris and I had spoken on the stairs. My Fae was rusty, and it probably sounded weird as hell with a southern accent. Anku smiled and raised his cup in salute.
So it's true. You know our ways and customs.
You knew I did, I said. You knew all about me before you ever sent your men to fetch me. The Ankus are well known for their thoroughness.
Theo laughed. Thank you for the compliment, Mr. Ballard. We found out as much as we could, he said. Most of it is urban legend and well-promoted myth. There is very little hard data in this world about you, Mr. Ballard, a remarkable feat in this age of digital scrying. Humans seem only too eager to lay every detail of their lives out for the world to see. But men like you, Mr. Ballard, you understand the power and currency of secrets.
Anku withdrew a diamond rose iPhone from his jacket pocket and pulled something up on the phone's screen.
Latham Ballard, he began. Born in Welch, West Virginia, United States. The exact date and time of birth has been obscured through both technology and ritual.
I had this Coptic horoscope assassin on me for a bit, I said. Triggerman, for the followers of Montanus, if he knew your date and time of birth, you were dead. Besides, birthday parties get kind of lame after your 12th is all downhill.
Anku continued reading. As for your childhood, both parents are reported deceased, names and locations unknown. A persistent rumor is that you raised the dead at the age of 10. You were also supposedly an inmate at the Western State Mental Hospital between the ages of 11 and 12. Again, all the records regarding that story can't be found.
I said nothing.
Ah. Anku said with a seam of a smile. Perhaps that one's a bit too close to home, yes?
I drained half my drink.
You were supposedly inducted into the Nightwise, a most prestigious honor for a wizard, Theo said, not even looking up from his phone. You are the only member of that august circle to ever be dishonored and cast out.
I wasn't fired, I quit, I said. More pricks in that august circle than on a cactus. Mr. White Wine chuckled at that. He covered his mouth as he did. Classy.
It is claimed that you are the man who stole the Philosopher's Stone from the mobster and master alchemist Joey Dross in 1999, then lost it in a high-stakes poker game, or over a woman, accounts vary. A few years ago, you and some accomplices broke into the U.S. Treasury Department in Washington, D.C., Anku said, putting his phone away, and supposedly made off with rune-etched currency, printing plates worth millions, infuriating the all-seeing eye in the process. Few men cross the Illuminati, the secret masters, and live. In 1996, you were the leader and sole survivor of a group of individuals that rescued dozens of Kolkata street children from a Brahmarakasa lair. You are said to be the only mortal wizard to have ever harnessed the power of the Tianzi tablets and not gone incurably mad. You are the subject of numerous documentaries, books, magazine articles, and social media fan pages. And if the myth has any truth to it, a cameo in at least one pornographic movie.
Harry Boffer and the Wand of Wonder, I offered happily.
Anku crossed his legs, angling his body toward me. You have decades of similar anecdotes surrounding you, Mr. Ballard. Depending on whom you ask, you've either stolen from, conned, betrayed, saved, or avenged pretty much everyone associated with the occult underworld. The life, I believe you people call it. You're a legend.
Okay, I said, taking another sip of my drink. My turn, and I don't even need to check an $8 million cell phone for this one. The Ankus are one of the last of the original Fae clans to still reside on Earth,
You were building exquisite architecture, creating literature, music, and art, and oh, being worshipped like gods, demons, and ancient astronauts when humanity was scratching the fleas off our asses in caves and trying to figure out the whole agriculture gig. Anku nodded and sipped from his goblet. He seemed very pleased with himself. These days, I continued, your family is pretty diversified. You own media corporations and banks. You pull diamonds, gold, silver, plutonium, all kinds of goodies out of the earth, and then you take profits from those and a bunch of other commodities all along the way from inception to market. You are